Welcome to the Mindful Medicina Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Jeanette Daniels. I'm a naturopathic medical doctor on a mission to inspire a renewed confidence in the intelligence of the human body. And joining the conversation today is my friend and colleague, Janelle Hartman, lymphatic and colon hydrotherapist, esteemed yoga teacher of teachers, and the co-producer of this show. Media has always force-fed humanity with lies and deceit. Like battery acid, the propaganda burns when you swallow it. You might think it's a little reflux, but it's not what is coming up. It is what is going down that is caustic. The system relies on your belief in it. It cannot exist without your dedication and commitment to it. Like any abusive relationship, it subsists on your skewed view of unconditional love, kindness, and care. It is not entirely our fault, however. We have been duped by the matrix since the day we were birthed in a hospital, injected with drugs and then injected with lies in the school system. Before you know it, the world has Stockholm syndrome and the abuser becomes the savior. Welcome in the COVID psyop. During the COVID era, we all tuned into the program from the bunkers of our modern-day caves, where 2 weeks became several years, with the ticker counter at the top of the screen validating the severity of this invisible enemy and your neighbors becoming accomplices and your breath a nuclear weapon. What if we had all just turned off the television? Today's guest, Kimberly Overton, a registered nurse and frontline worker in the ICU in Tennessee during the COVID era, is here to share with us what she witnessed firsthand and why she had to resign. In July of 2021, she founded Nurse Freedom Network to stand against the medical tyranny we are now facing. She is a graduate of Western Kentucky University and has worked in the healthcare industry for over 25 years, serving in both clinical and administrative roles. She has been a strong advocate for autonomy and informed consent throughout her career. Beyond the advocacy, her larger vision for Nurse Freedom Network has always been creating opportunities for nurses to break away from this broken and oppressive sick care system and empower them to cultivate their own environment, one in which both nurses and patients alike will thrive. In 2022, she founded Remnant Concierge Nursing Services, a private membership association specializing in the consultation and care of the vaccine injured. Kimberly also serves on the executive board of the newly formed National Coalition of Frontline Workers. We hope that this information today empowers all of you to question the narratives, to ask yourselves who stands to profit from any given agenda, and to just say no to living in an upside-down world. Today, we have Kimberly Overton with us, and she is a critical care registered nurse, founder of Nurse Freedom Network and Remnant Nursing, host on Nurses Out Loud, author, motivational speaker, patient, and nurse advocate. Welcome to Mindful Medicina, Kimberly.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yay. We wanted our audience to get a bird's eye view of what it was like to work in the ICU during the COVID era. Janelle and I are so grateful to have you here today to discuss what it was like to be in the trenches as a frontline worker at that time. While most of the world's perceptions were and still are based on what media wants us to think and feel, I wanted to share with our listeners a window into the lies of what was really going on in the hopes of breaking the long spell. Kimberly, we love your podcast, Nurses Out Loud.
It's so good.
Thank you. Yeah.
You interviewed Scott Shara, Grace's father, a while back, and we were so moved that we reached out and interviewed him ourselves. So he is undergoing a legal case against Ascension Health in the murder of his daughter during COVID, which in another interview I've heard you say, this is profound, that during COVID, it was like dying in a hospital holocaust.
Yes.
So with that said, we would love to hear about you and your experience as a frontline worker. Where do you work for? Where were you working first and foremost? And if you can give us a little history on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, thank you for having me and for the opportunity to share my experience during COVID. So I am a registered nurse and I've been in healthcare for 28 years. I was at the time when COVID came about, I was working in the ICU. I was in the critical care unit in Tennessee. And, you know, we started seeing things that were, I will say, different. We started seeing patients that were presenting differently somewhere around late 2019. I would say almost as far back as September 2019, where we started seeing these patients come in with respiratory disease, but it was not like anything we had ever seen before. It was very different. And then, of course, March of 2020 is when, you know, COVID kind of really came on the scene. And the only way that I can describe is just complete chaos. It was complete and utter chaos in the ICU. We had all of these patients coming in, and, you know, despite all of our best efforts, they just weren't getting any better. We were seeing them placed on ventilators, and we typically, when we had a patient on a ventilator in the ICU, they might be on it for 2 days, 3 days. We would wean them off. We were seeing really prolonged 2 weeks on ventilators. Typically that we never let it go that far. They would usually trach them. It was very odd. And it was like every policy and procedure that we knew prior to COVID, everything that we did kind of flew in the face of what we've always done. Think about your infection control policies, right? We were going from COVID patient room to non-COVID patient room with the same N95 mask on. And that's something, again, that infection control policies never would have allowed prior to COVID. So it was a lot of, we were asking a lot of questions. But what really had me asking questions was when we started using this medication, remdesivir. I don't know how familiar you are with that medication, but it's an antiviral medication. So in order for it to be effective, it relies on viral replication. Now, the problem with that is that these patients, by the time that they were getting to us in the ER, because if you remember, or the ICU, if you remember when you would go to the hospital, they were turning people away and they were basically saying, oh, you have COVID, you know, don't do anything, just go home, you know, come back if you can't breathe, pretty much. And that's what was happening. So by the time that they were getting back to us in the hospital, they were well past their replication phase. And I could never understand why we were using this medication that it, you know, at the time we knew that it had an increase in mortality. It had caused a decrease in renal function. So I started asking this question, like, why are we continuing to use this medication that's clearly doing more harm than good? And I had a bigger question, which is, why is the government financially incentivizing its use?
Yeah, and the remdesivir, too, like what you were saying, is the kidney, it really lowers the function of the kidney, and thereby you're gaining this fluid back up into the lungs, and you're calling it pneumonia, but you're actually causing that very thing.
Yeah, it wasn't COVID killing any of these patients. It was the treatment. It was the deadly hospital protocols that were killing them, just like you described. It lowers the renal function, and these patients were drowning from the fluid they were getting backed up into their lungs. And then we were putting them on ventilators, and then they were getting secondary infections. The patients were not dying of COVID. I mean, if we really started thinking about it, the only place anybody was dying was in the hospitals. Nobody was dying at home. Nobody was, we weren't pulling bodies off of the streets, right? The place that anybody was dying was in the hospitals. Mm-hmm. And it was because of these deadly hospital protocols. These patients were placed on the remdesivir. It was a dangerous, ineffective, it was an EUA or emergency use authorization drug at the time. Again, showing increased mortality, decrease in renal function. We had seen it given to patients who were already in renal failure. I saw it given to a patient who only had one kidney.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Is this why they call it run death is near?
Exactly. That's exactly what the nurses call it. Run death is near. Yeah. Because this is what was causing. That was what it was like, a never ending assembly line of death. It was remdesivir, ventilator, death. Wash, rinse, repeat.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Well, they had to create the illusion of a deadly virus, right?
Correct.
I don't know how much you get into the conversation around bioweapons, but it's not quite a virus as we know it. And so there are other things to consider and explore there as well that get your spidey senses kind of tickling. And being able to constantly have a viral infection and or flu season or any of these created pandemics justifies the need for vaccines, right? So if there was no virus, they really couldn't sell vaccinations.
Right. It was all very, very well orchestrated. And it was all leading up to this mass vaccination campaign. And, you know, I didn't come into the fight anti-vax. I honestly didn't. I had gotten all of my vaccines before I'd gotten my flu shot, not because I necessarily thought it was going to do anything, but, you know, it was not anything that I was really had gone down the rabbit hole about. So I didn't come in anti-vax, but the way that this particular vaccine was being pushed, and for me, in the beginning, it wasn't even so much that I thought anything nefarious was going on. I just thought, well, it was developed very quickly. And I thought, you know, I would be just fine. Even though I actually have a suppressed immune system, it took me probably 2.5 years before I even got COVID. And I was directly caring for these COVID patients in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So very interesting. But the things that were occurring in the hospital when, you know, the doctors were pushing, this has to be the single most egregious thing I have seen in my entire career, was that doctors were pushing for early intubation. And they were placing these patients on ventilators now, not because they were in respiratory distress, not because they were in respiratory failure, but they were doing this in an attempt to contain the virus. If you understand how a ventilator works, it's a closed loop system. So once that patient was on the ventilator, the virus would no longer be disseminated in the air. And they were doing that in an attempt to protect the nurses and the healthcare, the doctors, the healthcare workers. So right on its face, that's not about the patient in the bed. It's an extremely risky procedure. And they did this at the time, despite knowing the fact that approximately 80% of those patients we placed on ventilators did not survive. Mm-hmm. So they were in effect signing their death warrant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And there was a huge incentive for this. And we talked about this during Scott's episode. I mean, it was about a $39,000 payout per day on a ventilator.
Yeah, and it was more, it actually jumped. I can't remember the number, but if you kept that patient on a ventilator for 96 hours or more, the payout was higher.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's why they had them all. They kept these patients very heavily sedated. They kept them on these ventilators for these extended periods. And then many of them were then succumbing to secondary infections like ventilator-associated pneumonia. And we saw them passing of multi-organ dysfunction due to the remdesivir. We saw them start having strokes. Their kidneys were failing. I mean, nobody was dying of COVID. If you didn't go to the hospital, you fared pretty well. Even if you did nothing, you fared pretty well. You might have had a little bit of a difficult time there for a bit, but most people that stayed home did fine.
Mm-hmm. Well, if
even
you
are, with comorbidities.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if you know anything about viruses, if a virus is to thrive and continue proliferating, if you will, it doesn't want to kill the host. So right. Extremely deadly, quote unquote, deadly viruses, they don't jump from person to person. They're hoping to prolong the life of its host. So the whole thing doesn't make sense at all to me from the virology angle. So the ventilators ended up being sort of like gas chambers, if you will.
Yeah, I liken it to that often. It felt like a hospital holocaust, and like the ventilators are the new gas chambers. That's what it felt like.
And when
I couldn't stand it any longer. I ended up leaving the ICU because I wasn't going to watch one more of my patients needlessly die, especially when I knew that there was safe and effective treatment available, ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, which we knew was treating this virus, and people were doing very well on it, and it's safe, affordable, and effective. And the hospitals were denying this to the patients. I couldn't do it any longer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you weren't allowed to speak about alternative therapies because then they would not be able to legally push vaccinations. I don't know if that's the PrEP Act.
The vaccine, because the vaccine at the time was under an emergency use authorization, and you cannot have an emergency use authorization if there is any other viable treatment available.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. I remember posting on Facebook when all of this started, an article out of Wuhan showing that they were using 3,000 milligrams of IV vitamin C for patients, and they were coming out of the hospitals just fine. So I posted that, and it was immediately taken down, and that's when I realized this, what was happening, what the agenda was.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because we weren't using anything like vitamin C. They wouldn't even let us use ibuprofen. They said ibuprofen was contraindicated for COVID patients. I'd never heard anything so absurd. So they were basically doing nothing to mitigate the damage, right? I mean, it's a viral infection. It's a respiratory disease. It was going to be dead in 5 to 7 days anyway, but they did nothing to mitigate the damage. They weren't even giving steroids, or if they did give them, they were in such minuscule doses that, I mean, you could have spit on them and it would have been more effective.
And how could you know if it's something is contraindicated if it's quote unquote new?
Correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was just the most ridiculous thing I'd ever heard.
Mm-hmm. So everyone talks about how busy the hospital was. There were no beds. Can you give us a picture of what that looked like?
That was not true for most of the time. I'll tell you when it did get busy. During the initial Delta wave, there were a few people, but most of the people that were in my ICU were not even in there with COVID. We had one or two, but what we had were people that were in there who were so afraid to come into the hospital because the media had everybody so afraid to breathe air that they let all of their other medical conditions go, like their congestive heart failure, their diabetes. They weren't going to be seen. They weren't going into the hospital. They waited too long in most cases, so that by the time that they got into us, it was a lot of times the damage was irreversible. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't even a lot of times COVID. It was just that people were waiting too long to come into the hospital for other illnesses. But when we did see a big spike was somewhere around January of 2021. Then we were full at that time. But also, if we look back at what happened in like December of 2020, January of 2021, that's when the vaccines rolled out.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's when we had our highest numbers. Mm-hmm. And we were seeing vaccine injury at the bedside early on. And I'm talking about paralysis, strokes, blood clots, all of that we were seeing very, very early on in this rollout.
Yeah, Kimberly, I can speak to that working as a naturopath and keeping the clinic open at that time and throughout the whole entire time. That, and Janelle could speak to this as well because we worked at the same clinic. We really didn't see any sickness, you know, mm-hmm. and we didn't see any problems until the vaccines, using the term loosely, vaccines, rolled out. And then I actually started having patients who had severe negative side effects being, you know, I had a patient who went blind in his left eye after the first injection, and they did that in the hospital, and they immediately gave him a steroid and it didn't help, and he remained blind in the one eye. Got patients who have turbo cancers. That's huge because of the SV40 that is in these bioweapons. Mm-hmm. Cardiovascular disease, kidney disease, kidney cancer. The list just goes on and on. And the 30-year-old men that I'm seeing even today, even as of weeks ago, who have cardiovascular disease, the cardiomyopathies, Seattle, we just found out that 98% of King County here in Seattle was vaccinated, and we have some of the highest rates of cardiovascular disease of any state. So if one thing is true, it was not the original bioweapon that was released. It was the shots that caused disease and death.
That's 100% correct. 100% correct. That's when we started seeing everything. And what was happening was people, you know, they got everybody afraid of this virus. And then what they were doing was they were getting everybody vaccinated. And then people would get their one shot, their second shot. And if you remember, they did not consider you fully vaccinated until I believe it was 14 days after your second shot. Mm-hmm. So what was happening, people would get their shots, they would develop COVID despite their shots or because of them, whichever way you want to look at it. They would come into the hospital. If they died in those 14 days, they are now being recorded as an unvaccinated death. Mm-hmm. So that's really important to note. The other thing is that now you have all of these people who have, again, gotten vaccinated, gotten their first, their second, their however many boosters we're up to now. And then they are developing these myriad of symptoms and they're blaming it on long COVID.
Right. Yeah. And that's what we saw a ton of at the clinic, people coming in and just, they were so convinced it was from long COVID. It was a symptom of COVID. And it was just like, is there that much cognitive dissonance here?
The other term that's being thrown around is breakthrough infections. Well, we know that when you take these shots, you're still contagious, but what you are actually spreading is off-gassing of these bioweapons. Mm-hmm. And so the breakthrough infection that people are talking about is really just your own body making spike proteins and all the other nefarious things that are in these shots. I wouldn't necessarily say breakthrough infections. I'm kind of hoping to get away from that terminology and just say you're having side effects or fallout from taking these drugs.
Oh, exactly. And it's just amazing to me how people, you know, this far removed from the initial rollout they're still getting boosted. They're telling, so after I left the ICU, I started working, doing telephone triage nursing, and I would get all of these phone calls and a lot of them from young males that were having the cardiac side effects. But then I would get calls from people that would just complain that they were the sickest they have ever been in their life. And they can't understand why. Well, we're destroying your immune systems. Mm-hmm. I had seen people like adults with adult appendicitis. You very rarely see that, but we saw so many cases of adult appendicitis, strep throat, RSV. I had never seen in my nearly 30-year career, I'd never seen RSV in adults until like 2021. I had never seen that. Mm-hmm. But now it's everywhere. And all of a sudden, of course, they have a vaccine for it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And just the other, like yeah, the other thing that really took kind of skyrocketed was shingles, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's all of these, you know, they're pushing all of these different vaccines, whether it be the pneumonia vaccine, the shingles vaccine, and it doesn't prevent anything. In fact, I think it, you know, makes everything worse. I mean, they will not come at me with so much as a TB skin test at this point. I'm done with all of them. And I mean that because I literally, when I started my new job, I would not allow them to do a TB skin test on me. I said, you're going to have to do blood. I'm not doing it. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the hospitals were treating the nurses who didn't want to take the new drugs?
Shots? Not well. Yeah. Not well at all. I mean, we were made to be, you know, to feel like we didn't care about patients. We didn't care about our coworkers. They had us, you know, masking, or they wouldn't allow us to use the same break room if we weren't vaccinated. I mean, it was just awful. It was just awful the way that they were treating people. And from the very beginning, we knew that this, I don't even want to call it a vaccine. We knew that the jab did not prevent transmission. So it never made any sense to me why we would be treating people any differently. And they were, you know, shamefully firing their nurses. And that's when I started Nurse Freedom Network back in July of 2021, because I saw all of the mandates coming down and all of these nurses who had just worked through this entire pandemic were then getting fired for refusing the vaccine. But what was interesting is they could fire their staff nurse, and then they would go ahead and hire nurses through an agency who didn't require vaccination. So make that make sense.
Wow. Could I wanted to tie kind of these two things together a bit, Kimberly, and back up just a tad to these symptoms that people are, you know, really not identifying as being side effects, or even if they were. I'm curious about VAERS and the reporting system, and then, you know, your comments on that, and then how you were treated if you were asked to do a report or all the dynamics around that.
Yeah, well, I can tell you that, well, VAERS, first of all, right out of the gate, VAERS is a drastically underreported system. I think it's only capturing around 1%.
Yeah, that was a Harvard study.
Harvard Pilgrim did the study. It's only capturing about 1% of the reports. And most nurses don't even understand or know how to file a VAERS report. And they intentionally make it extremely complicated to do it. Like the system times you out after so long. And nobody was mentioning anything about VAERS reports. Absolutely nobody. And most nurses didn't even know what VAERS was. And, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with Nurse Ashley Grogg, who has heads up the VAERS project, and she's absolutely amazing, where she is educating nurses about VAERS and the public about VAERS, what it is, how to file a report. Because again, most nurses don't know what it is, don't know that they're mandatory reporters, and don't understand or even know how to begin the process of filing a VAERS report. And it's not for us to determine whether or not these symptoms were related to the vaccine, but if we vaccinated and they're having the symptoms, it is our responsibility and our obligation to report it. Mm-hmm. And that unfortunately wasn't happening.
And people were screaming about science and the scientific process and holding that up as some sort of like a demigod. And yet, if you cannot collect the data from your experiment, and there's no responsibility around that, because I just don't see that there was any system in place to actually, I mean, and I was surprised that people were not talking about that more. It, no matter what side of the line you land on with all of this, the process of science means we need to have a reporting system to see how this experiment is going.
Exactly. And it was just amazing to me that they kept saying, you know, you can't, you got to follow the science. You can't question the science. I mean, the very premise of science is based on a question.
Yep. That's right. That's right.
We should absolutely be asking questions. And you're correct. Nobody was capturing this data. I was, when I was on the telephone triage line, I was literally capturing my own data because there was no system in place for these people that were calling in, you know, with all of these very odd symptoms that, and the common denominator was that they were all just vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So I would keep a little notebook at my desk and I would keep my own data. But, you know, what ended up making me resign from my position as a nurse at that time was that they actually gave us a scripted answer when people would call or even parents would call and ask, you know, is the COVID vaccine safe to give my child? They actually gave us a scripted answer that said, and I have a screenshot of it. It says, yes, period. The vaccine is safe, period.
Wow.
And that was my hard line because there's no way we could have known that. We had no long-term safety data. The short-term data was certainly alarming. Mm-hmm. So to me, you know, it was not an easy choice to make, to give up my entire career, to give up my income and everything that I had. But I mean, it was a clear one. I was not going to recommend this vaccine for children. And they had a 99.9815% survival rate. Right. That should be criminal. And I think, you know, I would go further to say that any nurse or doctor or healthcare professional who even uttered the words safe and effective in the absence of clinical safety data, they should be stripped of their licensure and brought up on charges.
Right. So, it's, you know, first do no harm is a principle that has really been lost on the healthcare system over the last few, well, say four years now at least. You know, for me, when I, you know, of course I had patients ask me when these first rolled out, Would you do it? Should I do it? And honestly, my answer was I have absolutely no idea what is in these shots. And so I cannot recommend it. And in fact, when you opened up, say, for example, the Pfizer box and you pull out the vaccine, if you will, the paper actually says left blank intentionally that they weren't even transparent about the ingredients. Any other drug that you open up and you read the ingredients and the contraindications, et cetera, it's very transparent. This had nothing on the paper mm-hmm. to tell any of the healthcare professionals what was in it. If you read your food labels, well, you should be able to read what's on any given drug, what you're going to be giving a patient.
Exactly. And then there's no, even when you go to look up side effects of vaccines, every drug that is out there has a laundry list of side effects that comes with it. You know, if you ever watch the pharmaceutical commercials, they like read them, the laundry list of side effects. But if you ask for the side effects of a vaccine, you get, oh, you might have a sore arm. Mm-hmm. You might have a fever, a red swollen arm, but it'll pass. And that's it. Those are the only possible side effects from vaccines. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that's just absurd. Why is it so different mm-hmm. from drugs? And, you know, the drugs that the process to bring a drug to market is a lot more involved. The vaccines do not fall under the same category. They fall under a biologic. So it is very, very easy to get them without any safety testing. Mm-hmm.
Right. They're treated differently, even though they're all drugs. It's like the route of administration makes a difference on what you need to do to, you know, approve of it is just ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But that's intentional. So and so a lot of people didn't realize that this COVID mRNA vaccine is a gene therapy, categorized as nanoparticle technology, delivering nanoparticles. I mean, there's, like I mentioned earlier, the SV40 is connected to causing these turbo cancers. There's the synthetic spike proteins, lipid nanoparticles, naked mRNA, polyethylene glycol, and DNA plasmids, all to make a really very, very dangerous drug. And so many people have it, have had several, as you mentioned. I think we're up to 10 shots now.
I believe so. It's hard to believe that people are still rolling up their sleeve. Mm-hmm. When we know it doesn't work, we know it's not effective. They've all had it. And listen, I had COVID finally. It took me 2 years to get it. I had it one time and I treated it with ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, all of the supplements, and I was done in 48 hours. And all of these people that have been boosted to the hilt, they get COVID like every other month.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's like, and it's technically not COVID, right? It's like you're having side effects from, you know, this soup of madness. I wanted to ask you, because you had mentioned the N95s, and I wanted to go into the mask, because this illusion that this is crazy, the mask situation to me. Yeah. You know, you've got these cotton things over your face. You walk into a restaurant, you got to keep it on until you sit down. Then the virus doesn't know that you took it off. Can you tell us what was going on the mask front, and, you know, how effective or not effective these turn out to be?
Yeah. So those masks are not effective at all. They are not going to stop an aerosolized virus, period. So the masks are always about control. That's all. I mean, the mask might stop like droplets, but it's not going to stop an aerosolized virus, which COVID, they determined, was aerosolized. So it's not going to do anything. The N95 would be what you would need to wear. And that's not even filtering out everything.
Yeah, I heard that.
The fact that they were masking these children, it just makes me sick.
Seriously, so that's abuse. That's child abuse, 100%. The N95s, I heard a report about that, and how you literally have to have it fitted to your face perfectly. And if it is not, there's an experiment where they take a sugar, an aerosol sugar, and if you can smell it, it's not working.
That's correct. Yeah. Everybody, when you work in the hospital, all the nurses, all the doctors and healthcare workers, you get fit tested, and they do. They put a hood over you. They put the mask on. They spray all of these different things. And yes, if you can smell any of that, then that mask is not working for you. So if it's not perfectly fit tested to you, then it's not going to work. And the interesting thing about these masks, again, they had us wearing the same, and they would give us three masks for our shifts. So most nurses will work three 12-hour shifts. We would get three N95 masks. And then we were to put them in this magical brown paper bag that was supposedly supposed to just magically sanitize them. And then we would rewear them. So I, you know, when we had to do that over and over again until the masks broke. So I broke every mask. Oops. The elastic broke on every single mask.
Well, the mask exemptions weren't even being honored. I would have patients come in, be it they have, you know, asthma or even just PTSD around, you know, suffocation. You know, we won't go into all of the many reasons patients ask for mask exemption, but they weren't even being honored. They'd come back to me and tell me, this is what was alarming to me, is that the doctor actually lost control over the treatment of their own patient, and they became patients of the state, of the government, of their governor, and doctors had no authority.
Well, you know, and I hate to say this, I've worked with some great physicians, but most of them, without the benefit of like a protocol in front of them, would not know their ass from their elbow. I'm sorry to say it like that, but it's true. It's protocol medicine is a real problem in this country, and they only know how to treat with their prescription pad. That's all they do.
Yeah.
That's all they know. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really unfortunate. When I asked these physicians, I had three physicians at the time, because I was trying to get a medical exemption from the vaccine. And I had a rheumatologist, and then I had a neurologist, and I had my regular primary doctor. I asked all three of them, and all three of them refused.
Wow.
And I'm immune. I have multiple autoimmune conditions. And about 2 weeks prior to asking for that exemption, if you remember, they were not advising this for anyone with autoimmune conditions.
That's right.
And then all of a sudden it just kind of flipped and it was okay for everybody to get it. So I asked the doctor what had changed. I asked all three of them, what changed? Where's the data that shows me that now it's okay for me to take it? And nobody could answer that, because of course no data existed. And every one of them said the same thing to me. It was like, it was a scripted answer. They said, we just think, Kimberly, this is the only way out of this. Mm-hmm. Oh, was the vaccine.
Oh,
and, you know, I said, well, that's fine. I said, if I have to give up my career as a nurse and my job and my home or whatever, I will never be getting the shot. So
Good for you.
I drew a hard line.
Yeah.
It was definitely a lonely time in Seattle, Washington, because so many people, you know, and sometimes you start seeing that there are divisions politically that are showing up in the medicine, and politics should have absolutely nothing to do with medicine. But you start seeing all of the blue states rolling their sleeves up, and you're like, all of a sudden you're like, gosh, I think I need to move to a red state and become a conservative now. Like, how is my medicine changing my political stance? How are these two things married? And they are, and they shouldn't be.
They are, and I'll tell you, the politicization of healthcare was the death of it. But that is that's been going on for decades. But honestly, I mean, it does cross the political divide too. I mean, so I think in the red states, they're not so much wanting to mandate it, but there are plenty of conservatives that are pushing the vaccine. And I was a big Trump supporter, but President Trump was pushing it as well.
That's right.
So, you know, he didn't mandate it, so I'll be thankful for that. But there are a lot of conservatives, a lot of Democrats, Republicans, whatever you are, that are just, and it's just fear. You know, fear is a huge proponent in this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the true contagion.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you can't control the happy and the healthy, as I always say. So you really do need to create. So what they do a really good job of, the powers that be, is create a fear of being ostracized or judged, if you will, by your fellow people, your fellow man, and a fear of death. And as long as you can get people to be afraid of those things, what someone thinks of you and death, you can do you can get them to do anything, really.
That's true. But it was like, it was looking like Nazi Germany out here, as far as, you know, showing your vaccination papers and people not allowed to participate in society and being thrown out of restaurants and museums and all of the things that they wouldn't let us travel. And I mean, it was, I wouldn't know, I would just have like holed up in my home by myself and starved to death before I ever got this shot. But
yeah, because you're working from the position of principle and bodily autonomy. What, you know, it was a really stressful, challenging time for people because they did get concerned about losing their work, and some of them did, and then there was the issue of travel, et cetera, et cetera. But I think for the most part, I think the biggest problem is that people don't doubt their government or question them.
Mm-hmm. Right. They don't, you know, and it's just convenient, I guess, to listen. People are convinced that, you know, life is just too complex for them to, you know, be able to handle anything on their own. And they just listen to the CDC. And that's all the doctors do. You know, if you think the doctors are doing any independent research, let me tell you, they're not. Very few are out there doing any research. They literally just take whatever's handed down to them from the NIH, the CDC, the FDA, and they just parrot that to their patient population. And I mean, I'm just as guilty of that as well. And I have a lot of shame over that, you know, because I've vaccinated children. I don't believe in any vaccines at this point, but you know, I'd never taken a deeper look at it until COVID. COVID really, really opened my eyes to a lot of things. So, I mean, a lot of us are really guilty of kind of being asleep at the wheel too. And thankfully, I think if COVID has a silver lining, it is that so many people did start to wake up and become aware of really what's been going on for decades. Mm-hmm. If you think about all of these vaccine injured children and these, you know, these moms that have been out here, you know, begging for anybody to listen. Mm-hmm. And I have a lot of shame over that, because the only education as nurses that we receive on vaccines is safe, effective, and necessary, and nothing more. And doctors receive little more than that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you went through the standard allopathy system, which is run by the bankers. And so you were taught what you were taught. You know, the Merck manual is the Bible. And if this is happening, if the person has this, then you do this. And it's a playbook, right? Everything is a playbook. And so because you have a heart, you have shame and you feel bad about it because now you know, but you didn't know then. So you do have to have grace for yourself and yeah.
Absolutely. And this is, and redemption. I do. And I tell people that, especially the nurses, you know, you've got to have grace for yourself and for each other for what we didn't know at the time. But when we know better, we're called upon to do better. Mm-hmm. And you know, that's what I've done with Remnant Healthcare and creating opportunities for nurses to be able to come out of this broken system. That's what's so important, is that we, because I came out asking so many questions. I questioned every single thing I'd ever learned after COVID. And that's why I went and I was trained, and all of our nurses are trained in functional medicine, so that we can get to root cause and look at what's happening and eradicate it versus just going to that prescription pad every time. Yeah, that's not healthcare.
That's right. And what you realize is that the top three causes of death are actually all from drugs in the system itself, right? Cardiovascular disease, cancer, and iatrogenic deaths. This is all their creation, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's like, you know, we create the problem and sell you the cure.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Problem, reaction, solution.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about, before I forget, the PCR test. I wanted to rant about that because I wanted your perspective on it, you know, what that looked like. If you didn't get a shot, you had to constantly take, you know, a PCR test, which ended up being something that was never meant to test for viral genes. Or
it's not reliable. And you can get, if you cycle it enough times, you can get it to say whatever you want.
That's right.
But, you know, I never did the PCR testing. I just bowed out before I was going to do any of that. But yeah, they were forcing nurses to do PCR testing if they refused the shot. And I don't trust the test any more than I trust the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know. And a lot of people got nervous about the tests themselves being contagious. With the bioweapon, that I don't know, but I certainly never stuck anything up my nose. And I've never taken one of those tests. So the what you talked about, the cycles, the cycle threshold is true. It's like how many times they cycle it. You know, they were cycling. This gets complicated, so we won't go into detail here. But like if you do a 40 cycle on this, it'll show positive for anything, which is basically artifact. Unfortunately, a PCR is going to show you artifact. You don't know what that snot is, right?
Yep.
It could be dead tissue of your own. And so it was a test that was used to justify an infection that really wasn't as bad as they were selling it to us. And then they punished you by saying, well, if you're not going to get the shot, you have to test every day to come into work. Holy moly. It was like everything was punitive. You can't travel. You can't go out to eat. You can't. I think people need to really pay attention to what happened, because if they, and they will, do a round two of whatever, people need to say no. Just no.
No is a complete sentence. Mm. Absolutely.
In any language. Yeah.
It's unfortunate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Can't comply your way out of tyranny. Sorry. Correct. It's been tried. It doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
So after you left, tell us what you ended up embarking on.
Yeah. So I started Nurse Freedom Network back in July of 2021. We were a 501c3 nonprofit, and we got started really just doing protests at local hospitals that were firing their nurses. And, you know, I did that. I started building advocacy teams. I think we had gotten up to about 26 or close to 30 states where we had teams, and we were doing these protests across the country. But, you know, my larger vision for that was that I wanted to create opportunities for nurses and other healthcare workers to be able to break away from this system and to provide true patient-centered care that focused on getting people healthy and keeping people well and away from that corrupt sick care system that, you know, is basically murdering their patients for profit. Yeah. I've not found a nice way to say that. So it was Remnant Nursing. We've actually rebranded to Remnant Healthcare to encompass more disciplines. And we have opportunities. We are actually a private membership association. So we are completely outside of the mainstream. We anticipated that at some point they're going to come after our licensure. And under the PMA model, that licensure would not come into play. But that private membership association just guarantees our constitutionally guaranteed right to private contracts between ourselves and our members. So through that, we've been able to have nurses and healthcare practitioners, you know, treating patients and getting people well.
That's amazing.
Getting people well, the things that they are refusing to do in Western medicine.
Mm-hmm. Including advocacy. Can you tell us what you guys are doing with that on that front?
Yeah. Yeah. We've done a lot of advocacy cases. In fact, we had one a little over a year ago. We had a 4-year-old girl named Autumn. She was not just the latest victim of medical kidnapping in this country. And that's a very, very real problem in this country where children are, if you don't listen to their recommendations, or if you even dare question their recommendations, they are contacting CPS and they're taking children away from loving parents because they have just the gall to even ask a question about their child's care. So we had a big advocacy case that we were able to get this little 4-year-old home. And I mean, this girl was in a really desperate situation where it was one intervention after the next that really, it was just a cascade of events that had her declining. And they threw this little baby into renal failure through their medical interventions. Mm. And then they had her on a ventilator for extended periods. And I mean, it was just a mess, but we were able to get in there and advocate, and we were able to get her home. So I'm really, really proud of my team for that. And we went public with it, and I'm very proud of the fact that we shut down about 4 telephone lines at Lucile Packard over there in Palo Alto, California, because we had people calling in and letting them know, you know, the world is watching. Mm-hmm. And you're not in a vacuum. The world is watching, and you know, watch what you do. And we were able to get that girl home. So that's the biggest thing I always tell people. If you're going into this system, you need to have an advocate in place. You absolutely need to have an advocate. And we do offer that as part of our services. We offer the healthcare end of it, but we do also offer the advocacy services as well. You need somebody that understands the complexities of this broken system and how to navigate it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we'll be putting that in the show notes as well, like all of this information that you're giving us and that you're participating with.
Yeah, thank you. You can send them to the website. It's remnanthealthcare.org. And it's our plan start at $30 a month to become a member. And, you know, we're completely self-sustainable. We don't have any funding whatsoever, which I like, because it is, we don't answer to anybody. You know, there's nobody funding us that is going to be passing down, you know, all of these edicts and things that we have to follow. Nobody is going to dictate the care that we provide to these patients. And we do have ivermectin, and we're able to provide that for them as well to get them through the COVID season. Mm-hmm. So if you're in need of ivermectin, you can certainly reach out to us.
Oh, that's great.
And we can ship worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. Thanks, Kimberly.
Yeah, Kimberly, I know that, you know, it was a big deal for you to leave your job, because since I remember hearing an interview with you that you, since you were a kid, you knew you wanted to be a nurse. And to see you break away from the system that is in place and to create another way that is actually healing and loving is really what you are meant to do, I believe, because you had the calling as a child. And I admire you for having the courage to walk away from a broken system that's nefarious and to just to keep your heart open and figure out another way to do what you love. I'm so stoked about you guys. I want to create a doctor version of something like that.
Right.
But yeah.
Well, I'm always trying to get, you know, the doctors and the nurses together. And we do have doctors on our platform as well. So we that's why I rebranded to Remnant Healthcare. I started out as Remnant Nursing, but it's going to take all of us, the doctors, the nurses, the homeopaths, the naturopaths, all of us need to come together to build this system that we want. So it can't just be, you know, one group or the other. We need to find ways to all work together for best patient outcomes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Your story is just so incredible. And we're just so grateful that you took some time out and carved some time to be with us today. As far as links for people to be able to follow you, to hear about you, can you give us like your podcast, all of that good stuff?
Yeah. So you can go to, for the podcast, it's Nurses Out Loud. Our website is nursesoutloud.com, or you can also listen on, of course, the AmericaOutloud.news website. And then Remnant Healthcare is remnanthealthcare.org. And you can sign up for a membership. We offer, again, advocacy and health and wellness programs. And then, of course, Nurse Freedom Network is nursefreedomnetwork.org. I think that's enough websites. I've got too many, I feel. Too many groups, too many organizations, too many websites.
Hey, the more of this stuff, the merrier. That's what right. I say. Good. Yes. Right. Well, thank you so much, Kimberly, for coming on today.
Yeah, thanks, Kimberly.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for all the work you do in the world.
God bless.
Thank you. You as well.
We hope this conversation has empowered you. Remember, you are unique and you are a miracle. Your body doesn't make mistakes. It responds perfectly to an imperfect environment. Until next time, go get that life.